For the last couple of decades, the digital world we all live in has basically been built like a medieval map.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? You had these massive, towering fortresses, Apple over here, Microsoft over there, Sony across the moat.
All heavily guarded.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you wanted the cool stuff inside their walls, you had to pledge your allegiance.
Yeah, you bought their hardware.
You bought the hardware, you stayed inside their garden, and you definitely did not talk to the people outside the walls.
Never.
But you know, what happens to your data, or your money, and your security when those fortresses just, well, collapse overnight?
That's the big question right now.
It is. So we are pulling from the June 17th, 2026 Tikkun morning briefing today. And our mission for this deep dive is to uncover this massive structural shift happening across technology right now.
The landscape is completely changing.
It really is. The walled garden is dead. We are going to explore how the old boundaries of exclusivity are just falling apart all at once. I mean, in console gaming, enterprise security, mobile interfaces, and even global finance.
Yeah, it's a really profound architectural shift.
Right.
To kind of set the baseline for what we're going to uncover for you today, the overarching theme in the source material is that adaptability and really platform agnosticism, those are the new competitive
Which
advantages.
is wild to think about.
It is. The companies, the hackers, and the financial institutions that are winning today, they're the ones who just completely refuse to be boxed in by those old medieval borders.
Okay, well, let's start with the loudest crash of a digital wall falling, because Microsoft is voluntarily taking a sledgehammer to its oldest, most sacred exclusivity rule.
Yeah, this one is huge.
It's crazy. On July 28, Halo Campaign Evolved is launching simultaneously on Xbox, PC, and PlayStation 5.
And, they are going far beyond just a simple port to the PS5.
Wait, really?
Yeah, Microsoft is actually heavily investing in PS5 Pro optimization.
Okay, let's unpack this, because that is the part I find so hard to wrap my head around.
I know, it sounds counterintuitive.
We're talking native 4K resolution, right? 60 frames per second advanced ray tracing.
Yep, all of it.
And Microsoft is actually using the captured on PS5 Pro branding on their official cinematic trailers.
Which is just unheard of.
It's unprecedented. To me, this is like it's like Apple deciding to make iMessage exclusive to Android,
Right.
or Netflix deciding Stranger Things is better off premiering on Hulu. I mean, why would they give their absolute crown jewel, Master Chief, to their biggest competitor? Aren't they basically admitting defeat in the console war?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, they really aren't admitting defeat.
Okay.
They're just playing a completely different game now. I mean, the era of the hardware loss leader, it's effectively over.
You mean selling the console at a loss?
Exactly. Let's break down the mechanics of that old traditional console model. Historically, companies sold the plastic and silicon box at a loss, or maybe a razor-thin margin,
Right, just to get it in your house.
right, to trap you in their ecosystem.
Okay.
And then they took a 30% cut of all the software. But look at where we are today. Sony has around 60 million PS5s in the wild.
Wow, and Xbox.
Xbox only has about 28 million Series X and S consoles combined.
Oh, wow.
Half.
Less than half. Microsoft simply cannot compete on the hardware install base anymore. So, as a $2 trillion company, they've realized that software return on investment is just far more lucrative than hardware loyalty.
Okay, but how much more lucrative? Like, give me the math on why handing Halo to Sony makes sense for Microsoft's bottom line.
Sure, let's run the financial modeling from the briefing.
Yeah.
So, if Microsoft sells just 5 million copies of this new Halo on the PS5 at $60 a pop, they gross $300 million.
Okay, but Sony takes a cut, right?
Yeah, Sony takes their standard 30% platform cut,
Right.
but that still leaves Microsoft with a net of $210 million.
Okay.
And that $210 million in pure software margin, it completely destroys the profit they would make from selling 3.5 million Xbox Series X consoles.
Wait, really? Selling 3.5 million consoles makes less than that.
Oh, easily. The consoles only net about $50 in profit per unit after manufacturing and all those distribution subsidies. Wow. So they are essentially looking at Sony's 60 million users not as the enemy camp anymore,
Nope.
but as like an untapped printing press for their own software revenue.
That is the pragmatic reality of it. They aren't abandoning their ecosystem, they're just redefining it.
Redefining it how?
Well, Microsoft retains 100% of the revenue from their Game Pass subscriptions.
Right.
So if you're an Xbox player, you get Halo Day One on Game Pass for $16.99 a month. In fact, early access on July 23 is exclusive to Game Pass Ultimate and Premium buyers.
Oh, I see.
So they're taking that ubiquity strategy, the exact same one that made Azure and Office 365 so dominant in the enterprise world.
Right. Make it everywhere.
Exactly. Applying it to gaming. Make the software available everywhere, but make your native subscription the absolute best, most frictionless way to access it.
Which totally shifts the dynamic for you, the listener. You know, if you are a gamer, you literally no longer need to buy an Xbox to play its best game.
You really don't.
You can just boot up your PS5 Pro. And if you're an investor, this signals Microsoft's absolute confidence in long-term recurring revenue.
Oh, totally.
They just don't care what plastic box is sitting under your TV as long as you are paying them a monthly fee for the software running on it.
And that puts immense pressure on Sony, by the way.
How so?
Well, Sony now has to justify the value of the PS5 beyond just having exclusive games. Microsoft is proving in real time that exclusive content doesn't drive hardware sales the way it used to. Subscriptions drive revenue.
Right. So we have Microsoft tearing down its own gaming walls voluntarily because the math demands it.
Yeah.
But at the exact same time, Microsoft's corporate security walls are being completely bypassed by force.
Yeah, the timing documented in the briefing here is just staggering.
We have to talk about Nightmare Eclipse. Yeah. Because Microsoft released its massive June 10 patch Tuesday update addressing, what, like 200 vulnerabilities?
Yeah, it was their biggest security patch ever.
Yeah. Ever. And just hours later, a security researcher operating under the handle Nightmare Eclipse drops a zero-day exploit called Rogue Planet.
Hours later.
Hours later. And it targets a fully patched Microsoft Defender on Windows 10 and 11.
And keep in mind, this is not an isolated proof of concept. This is Nightmare Eclipse's seventh zero-day exploit released in just 3 months.
That's terrifying. Well, here's where it gets really interesting. I read through the technical breakdown of how Rogue Planet works, and I need you to translate this.
Sure.
Because the irony of the exploit is just chilling. The attacker is essentially tricking the security guard, Microsoft Defender, into carrying the bomb directly into the vault.
Yes.
It uses what the briefing calls a race condition and a junction point swap in the quarantine process.
Right.
How does an attacker trick the very software designed to stop it?
Well, let's look at it mechanically. Think of a junction point in an operating system, like a magical door in a hallway. Normally, when Defender spots a malicious file, it grabs that file, opens the door, and throws it into a secure quarantine vault so it can't harm your computer.
Makes sense.
Right. A race condition means exploiting the microscopic fraction of a millisecond between when Defender checks the door and when it actually walks through it.
So the attacker is manipulating that specific millisecond.
Yes. The security guard checks the door, sees it leads to the safe quarantine vault, and grabs the malicious file.
Okay.
But in the exact millisecond the guard opens a door, the hacker swaps the blueprint of the building.
Oh, wow.
So that door no longer leads to quarantine. It leads directly into the core control room of the operating system.
And Defender just walks right in.
Exactly.
Mm.
Because Microsoft Defender is the one moving the file, the system assumes the action is authorized. It executes the malicious payload with system-level privileges.
Okay, we should definitely clarify why system-level access is so much worse than just getting a user's password. Because I think most people assume administrator is the highest level of access on a computer.
In the Windows architecture, system privileges are actually higher than administrator rights.
Higher than admin.
Yes. It is the absolute core operating system level.
Yeah.
When an attacker gets system access, they can completely disable all antivirus software.
Wow.
They can install rootkits that embed themselves so deep in the machine that wiping the hard drive might not even remove them.
That's insane.
And they can move laterally across an entire corporate network entirely undetected. It is the holy grail for ransomware operators because you just own the foundational architecture of the machine.
So the walled garden of the operating system is completely compromised from the inside out.
Yeah, and the real world consequences of this collapsing perimeter are happening right now.
Like with Shiny Hunters.
Exactly. While the zero day is circulating, ransomware gangs like Shiny Hunters are exploiting these exact kinds of vulnerabilities.
All right, the briefing mentioned they just breached 2.2 million Kodak records.
Yep, and they've set a June 18 deadline for extortion. They are actively targeting over 100 organizations right now.
Unbelievable.
The traditional data perimeter, you know, the idea that you can just put a firewall up, run basic antivirus, and sit safely inside your digital castle, that's failing.
So if you are listening to this right now and you manage IT for an organization or you run a business, what is the immediate move? I mean, you can't rely on Defender if Defender is the delivery mechanism.
No, you can't. You must implement Defense in Depth immediately. Do not rely solely on Microsoft Defender.
Okay. What does the briefing suggest?
The briefing recommends implementing application allow listing, specifically solutions like ThreatLocker.
Allow listing. How does that differ from traditional antivirus?
It fundamentally flips the security model. Instead of looking for bad files to block, it blocks absolutely everything by default unless it is explicitly on a pre-approved list.
Oh, so it just shuts everything down.
Right. In lab testing, ThreatLocker blocked the Rogue Planet exploit because it prevents unauthorized executables from running at all, even if they somehow acquire system rights.
That's a huge distinction.
You also need to heavily restrict local admin access to limit initial entry points. And use endpoint detection and response, or EDR solutions, to monitor for unexpected Windows error reporting behaviors.
Windows error reporting.
Yeah, that specific error reporting channel is how Rogue Planet actually triggers its payload.
Okay. So we are seeing these massive enterprise fortresses getting bypassed by, frankly, clever misdirection, and gaming consoles losing their exclusive borders.
Yeah.
But this dissolution of boundaries isn't just happening in corporate server rooms or our living rooms. It's fundamentally changing the architecture of the one device you hold in your hand every minute of the day.
The mobile phone.
Yes, the mobile phone. Google's June 16th release of Android 17 and Wear OS 7 is a prime example of this.
Oh, it really is.
It's rolling out to the Pixel 8 and newer devices first, and the star feature is called Bubbles.
Some bubbles.
Yeah. Historically, mobile phones have been the ultimate walled garden for human attention.
Right? Totally.
You open an app, and it takes over your entire screen. If you want to use another app, you have to swipe away, put the first app in the background, and open the new one.
Yeah, it's very siloed.
Right. It's a very rigid one-apper-screen paradigm. But Bubbles allows any app to become a floating, resizable window that just persists on your screen.
It shatters that rigid user experience.
It really does. It's like turning your phone screen from a single-track train where apps just wait in line into a bustling, free-for-all intersection where everything happens at once. You can have a YouTube video floating over your email while your calendar is tucked into the corner and a calculator is hovering near your thumb.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is the strategic warfare behind this feature. That's the piece most people miss.
Really? Who are they targeting?
This is a calculated strike directly against Apple.
Oh, interesting.
Apple has been trying to push productivity with iPadOS and their Stage Manager feature.
Yeah.
But that experience is mostly locked to tablets and high-end hardware.
Right. It's not really a phone thing.
Exactly. Google is bringing PC-level floating window multitasking natively to the smartphone form factor. They are actively trying to make Android the premier platform-agnostic tool for productivity, regardless of the screen size.
And the way they are powering this seamless multitasking is through AI, specifically Gemini Omni. But I want to understand how this actually breaks down the walls between apps. How does AI change the way the operating system handles data?
Well, historically, an operating system was kind of like a rigid filing cabinet.
Okay.
You had a text parser for text files, an image parser for photos, an audio driver for music. They lived in separate rooms and didn't talk to each other well.
Right.
Gemini Omni is a multimodal model. It digests raw data regardless of the file type.
So it doesn't care what the file is?
Nope. Think of the new OS architecture less like a filing cabinet and more like a master translator sitting in the middle of a UN conference. It can instantly process a photo, text, audio, and video simultaneously without ever needing to switch rooms or open a different app.
Which perfectly explains the integration of Lyria 3.
Yes. Lyria 3 is their new generative model. It can generate 30 to 90 second music tracks entirely from a text prompt.
Wow.
Because the OS doesn't care what format the data is in anymore, the boundary between a text messaging app, a photo editor, and a music creation tool is completely blurring.
They all just blend together.
Exactly. The AI handles the input natively across all of them, removing the friction of moving between different walled software gardens.
It changes the phone from a collection of isolated apps into one continuous fluid interface. Which brings us to the final and maybe the most globally significant wall that is coming down today. Capital.
Yes, the financial aspect.
The borders of global finance. Because this seamless, borderless multitasking we are seeing on our phones, that is exactly what massive financial institutions are trying to achieve with their money.
And the data we have from the blockchain sector on this is just stunning.
Right.
Over the last 90 days, the XRP ledger, or XRPL, has drawn $1.9 billion in net real-world asset inflows.
Okay, let's define real-world assets, or RWAs, for a second for everyone.
Yeah.
Because we aren't talking about meme coins here. We are talking about taking traditional, heavily regulated financial instruments like government treasury bonds or private credit funds and tokenizing them so they can move on a blockchain.
Correct. You are digitizing a legal claim on a real-world bond.
Hmm.
And that $1.9 billion inflow figure is massive because it actually beat Ethereum.
Which is huge.
Yeah. Ethereum only saw $1.6 billion in inflows over the same 90-day period.
Okay, wait a minute. Stop right there because I have to push back on this.
Go ahead.
Ethereum has been the undisputed king of smart contracts and institutional finance for years. Are you telling me David just permanently slayed Goliath in a single quarter? Should I be moving all my assets right now?
Well, this raises an important question, but we need a reality check here.
Okay.
Why is institutional money suddenly flooding into XRPL instead of the most established network? It comes down to the raw mechanics of how these networks process data.
Seed, right.
Yeah, exactly. XRPL is having an incredible quarter because it's winning massive institutional treasury settlements. For example, Ondo Finance recently designated XRPL as a primary network and locked up $274 million there.
That's a massive chunk of change.
It is. In traditional finance, moving a massive tranche of government bonds takes days. It's called T+2 settlement, trade date plus 2 days for the clearinghouses to actually verify and move the assets.
And Ethereum obviously speeds that up.
Ethereum speeds it up, sure. But a transaction might still take 12 seconds to finalize.
Okay.
And it could cost you anywhere from $5 to $20 in gas fees, depending on network congestion.
Right.
XRPL settles transactions natively in 3 to 5 seconds. And the fees are under a tenth of a cent. Institutional capital loves that frictionless efficiency for moving massive episodic treasury assets.
But does that mean Ethereum is losing its grip on the market? Like, should an investor be jumping ship to XRPL right now based on this 90-day window?
No, absolutely not. The data tells a completely different, much more sobering story. Ethereum is not dying.
Okay, good to know.
Ethereum still commands a massive 52.8% market share of the entire tokenized asset space. That is roughly $17 billion in total value locked.
So it's still dwarfing everyone else.
Completely. Ethereum has the deep ecosystem maturity, thousands of decentralized apps, and immense liquidity. Think of it from an architecture standpoint. XRPL is acting like MasterCard to Ethereum's Visa.
Ah, I like that analogy.
Yeah, they're both highly valuable, but they serve different transaction profiles. XRPL is winning specific high-speed, treasury-scale transfers, while Ethereum remains the foundational settlement layer for complex, decentralized finance.
So the big whales are using XRPL for specific high-speed routing.
Yeah.
But there's a massive red flag in the source data here that we need to point out for you, the listener.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially if you actively manage a portfolio. I'm looking at the geographic concentration of these XRPL flows.
It changes the entire narrative of the $1.9 billion surge.
Exactly. 31% of all global XRP wallet flows right now are concentrated on a single exchange, Upbit, located in South Korea.
Yeah.
Break down why that specific data point is such a glaring warning sign.
Well, if you are managing a portfolio, here is why that South Korean data point is a massive red flag for you. Institutional money is stable. It buys, it holds, it seeks yield over years.
Right.
Upbit, historically, is driven by highly speculative retail trading. And retail speculative money is highly volatile. It day trades, it chases trends, and it panic sells.
It's all emotion.
Exactly. So even though the headlines say billions in institutional money flowing to XRPL, a massive chunk of the actual daily network volume is being driven by South Korean retail speculation, not broad-based Western institutional adoption.
Which totally explains the price action, or, you know, lack thereof.
Hmm.
Despite this massive RWA surge, XRP's price remains totally flat. It's just ranging between $1.20 and $1.29.
It suffers from a speculative overhang. The institutional money coming in is essentially being suppressed by the volatility of day traders.
So it's a trap.
Kind of. If you buy in now thinking it's a safe, stable institutional play, you're actually stepping into a highly volatile retail casino.
So what is the actionable takeaway for an investor navigating this space?
Restraint. XRP is an interesting 5 to 10% speculative diversification play in a broader portfolio.
Just a small piece?
Right. The underlying technology proves that low-fee, high-speed blockchains have a real, permanent place in global finance. But do not make it a core holding yet.
Right.
You need to wait until the ongoing SEC litigation risks are fully resolved in the United States. And you need to see that network adoption broaden significantly beyond just South Korean retail speculation. The technology is sound, but the market dynamics are currently too concentrated.
Oh, okay, wow. We have covered massive terrain in this deep dive, but the through line is undeniable. The medieval map of the digital world is being rewritten right in front of us.
It really is.
We've seen Master Chief abandon his Xbox exclusivity to run natively on a PlayStation because the math of the old hardware wars just doesn't work anymore. We've seen hackers completely bypass the walls of Microsoft Defender, tricking the core operating system into handing over its own keys. We've explored how Android is using multimodal AI to break apps out of their full-screen prisons to float freely across our devices.
It's everywhere.
And we've seen billions of dollars in tokenized treasury bonds flowing instantly across borderless ledgers. Oh, and looking at the briefing notes, I just have to throw this in. Even Pinhead is breaking out.
Oh yeah, the game.
Hellraiser Revival, the game launches October 8, and Doug Bradley is back, voicing the iconic villain, breaking out of the labyrinth to haunt players across all platforms simultaneously.
The walls are coming down across literally every sector.
So what does this all mean for you, the person navigating this newly borderless world?
Well, it leaves us with a profound, lingering question to mull over long after you finish listening. If exclusivity is truly dead, and the walled gardens of tech, gaming, and finance are all collapsing into one giant interoperable ecosystem, what happens to our digital identities?
That's a great point.
When every platform shares everything, when your game saves, your money, and your apps just float seamlessly across any device made by any company, will you ever truly own your software, your games, or your data again? Or are we all just permanently subscribing to a borderless world that we have absolutely no control over?